minute. I bet he has a secret love child, Nora says. Or he's gay. Or he has a secret gay love child. It's probably in case I see his equerry putting his batteries back in, Alex says. Anyway, this is boring. What's going on with you? Your life is so much better than mine right now. Well, Nora says, Nate Silver won't stop blowing up my phone for another column. Bought some new curtains, narrowed down the list of grad school concentrations to statistics or data science. Tell me those are both at GW, Alex says, hopping up to sit on one of the immaculate countertops, feet dangling. You can't leave me in D.C. to go back to MIT. Haven't decided yet, but astonishingly, it will not be based on you, Nora tells him. Remember how we sometimes talk about things that are not about you? Yeah, weirdly. So, is the plan to dethrone Nate Silver as reigning data czar of D.C.? Nora laughs. No, what I'm going to do is silently compile and process enough data to know exactly what's going to happen for the next 25 years. Then, I'm going to buy a house on the top of a very tall hill at the edge of the city and become an eccentric recluse and sit on my veranda. Watch it all unfold through a pair of binoculars. Alex starts to laugh, but cuts off when he hears rustling down the hall, quiet footsteps approaching. Princess Beatrice lives in a different section of the palace, and so does Henry. The PPOs and his own security sleep on this floor, though, so maybe... Hold on, Henry says, covering the speaker. A light flicks on in the hallway, and the person who comes padding into the kitchen is none other than Prince Henry. He's rumpled and half awake, shoulders slumping as he yawns. He's standing in front of Alex wearing not a suit, but a heather gray t-shirt and plaid pajama bottoms. He has earbuds in, and his hair is a mess. His feet are bare. He looks alarmingly human. He freezes when his eyes fall on Alex, perched on the countertop. Alex stares back at him. In his hand, Nora begins a muffled, "Is that?" before Alex disconnects the call. Henry pulls out his earbuds, and his posture has ratcheted back up straight, but his face is still bleary and confused. "Hello," he says, hoarse. "Sorry, I was just... Cornetto's." He gestures vaguely toward the refrigerator, as if he said something of any meaning. What? He crosses to the freezer and extracts the box of ice cream cones, showing Alex the name Cornetto across the front. "I was out. Knew they'd stocked you up." "Do you raid the kitchens of all your guests?" Alex asks. "Only when I can't sleep," Henry says, "which is always. Didn't think you'd be awake." He looks at Alex, deferring, and Alex realizes he's waiting for permission to open the box and take one. Alex thinks about telling him no, just for the thrill of denying a prince something, but he's kind of intrigued. He usually can't sleep either. He nods. He waits for Henry to take a cornetto and leave, but instead, he looks back up at Alex. "Have you practiced what you say tomorrow?" "Yes," Alex said, bristling immediately. This is why nothing about Henry has ever intrigued him before. "You're not the only professional here." "I didn't mean," Henry falters. "I only meant, do you think we should, rehearse?" "Do you need to? I thought it might help." Of course he thinks that. Everything Henry's ever done publicly has probably been privately rehearsed in stuffy royal quarters like this one. Alex hops down off the counter, swiping his phone unlocked. "Watch this." He lines up a shot. The box of Cornettos on the corner, Henry's hand braced on the marble next to it, his heavy signet ring visible along with a swath of pajamas. He opens up Instagram, slaps a filter on it. "Nothing cures jet lag," Alex narrates in a monotone as he taps out a caption, "like midnight ice cream with @PrinceHenry. Geotag, Kensington Palace. And posted." He holds the phone for Henry to see, as likes and comments immediately pour in. "There are a lot of things worth overthinking, believe me, but this isn't one of them." Henry frowns at him over his ice cream.
I suppose,
he says, looking doubtful. Are you done? Alex asks. I was on a call. Henry blinks, then folds his arms over his chest, back on the defensive.
Of course. I won't keep you.
As he leaves the kitchen, he pauses in the doorframe, considering. I didn't know you wore glasses, he says finally. He leaves Alex standing there alone in the kitchen, the box of Cornettos sweating on the counter. The ride to the studio for the interview is bumpy, but mercifully quick. Alex should probably blame some of his queasiness on nerves, but chooses to blame it all on this morning's appalling breakfast spread. What kind of garbage country eats bland beans on white toast for breakfast? He can't decide if his Mexican blood or his Texan blood is more offended. Henry sits beside him, surrounded by a cloud of attendants and stylists. One adjusts his hair with a fine-toothed comb. One holds up a notepad of talking points. One tugs his collar straight. From the passenger seat, Sean takes a yellow pill out of a bottle and passes it back to Henry, who readily pops it into his mouth and swallows it dry. Alex decides he doesn't want or need to know. The motorcade pulls up in front of the studio, and when the door slides open, there's the promised photo line and barricaded royal worshippers. Henry turns and looks at him, a little grimace around his mouth and eyes.
Prince goes first, then you, Sean says to Alex, leaning in and touching his earpiece.
Alex takes one breath, two, and turns it on. The megawatt smile. The all-American charm. Go ahead, Your Royal Highness, Alex says, winking as he puts on his sunglasses. Your subjects await. Henry clears his throat and unfolds himself, stepping out into the morning and waving genially at the crowd. Cameras flash. Photographers shout. A blue-haired girl in the crowd lifts up a homemade poster that reads in big, glittery letters, Get in me, Prince Henry, for about 5 seconds until a member of the security team shoves it into a nearby trash can. Alex steps out next, swaggering up beside Henry and throwing an arm over his shoulder.
Act like you like me, Alex says cheerfully.
Henry looks at him like he's trying to choose between a million choice words, before tipping his head to the side and offering up a well-rehearsed laugh, putting his arm around Alex, too.
There we go.
The hosts of this morning are agonizingly British. A middle-aged woman named Dottie in a tea dress and a man called Stu, who looks as if he spends his weekends yelling at mice in his garden. Alex watches the introductions backstage as a makeup artist conceals a stress pimple on his forehead.
So this is happening.
He tries to ignore Henry a few feet to his left, currently getting a final preening from a royal stylist. It's the last chance he'll get to ignore Henry for the rest of the day. Soon, Henry is leading the way out with Alex close behind. Alex shakes Dottie's hand first, smiling his politics smile at her, the one that makes a lot of congresswomen, and more than a few congressmen, want to tell him things they shouldn't. She giggles and kisses him on the cheek. The audience claps and claps and claps. Henry sits on the prop couch next to him. Perfect posture, and Alex smiles at him, making a show of looking comfortable in Henry's company. Which is harder than it should be, because the stage lights suddenly make him uncomfortably aware of how fresh and handsome Henry looks for the cameras. He's wearing a blue sweater over a button-down, and his hair looks soft.
Whatever. Fine. Henry is annoyingly attractive. That's always been a thing, objectively. It's fine.
He realizes, almost a second too late, that Dottie is asking him a question.
What do you think of jolly old England then, Alex? Dottie says, clearly ribbing him.
Alex forces a smile.
You know, Dottie, it's gorgeous, Alex says. I've been here a few times since my mom got elected, and it's always incredible to see the history here.
And the beer selection. The audience laughs right on cue, and Alex shakes out his shoulders a little.
And of course, it's always great to see this guy.
He turns to Henry, extending his fist. Henry hesitates before stiffly bumping his own knuckles against Alex's with a heavy air of an act of treason.
Alex's whole reason for wanting to go into politics, when he knows so many past presidential sons and daughters have run away screaming the minute they turned 18, is he genuinely cares about people. The power is great, the attention fun, but the people are everything. He has a bit of a caring too much problem about most things, including whether people can pay their medical bills, or marry whomever they love, or not get shot at school. Or in this case, if kids with cancer have enough books to read at the Royal Marsden NHS Foundation Trust. He and Henry and their collective horde of security have taken over the floor, flustering nurses and shaking hands. He's trying, really trying, not to let his hands clench into fists at his sides. But Henry's smiling robotically with a little bald boy plugged full of tubes for some bullshit photograph, and he wants to scream at this whole stupid country. But he's legally required to be here, so he focuses on the kids instead. Many of them have no idea who he is, but Henry gamely introduces him as the president's son. And soon, they're asking him about the White House, and does he know Ariana Grande? And he laughs and indulges them. He unpacks books from the heavy boxes they've brought, climbs up onto beds, and reads out loud, a photographer trailing after him. He doesn't realize he's lost track of Henry until the patient he's visiting dozes off, and he recognizes the low rumble of Henry's voice on the other side of the curtain. A quick count of feet on the floor. No photographers. Just Henry. He steps quietly over to the chair against the wall, right at the edge of the curtain. If he sits at the right angle and cranes his head back, he can barely see. Henry is talking to a little girl with leukemia named Claudette, according to the board on her wall. She's got dark skin that's turned sort of a pale gray and a bright orange scarf tied around her head, emblazoned with the Alliance Starbird. Instead of hovering awkwardly, like Alex expected, Henry is squatting at her side, smiling and holding her hand. "Star Wars fan, are you?" Henry says, in a low, warm voice Alex has never heard from him before, pointing at the insignia on her headscarf.
"Oh, it's my absolute favorite," Claudette gushes. "I'd like to be just like Princess Leia when I'm older, because she's so tough and smart and strong, and she gets to kiss Han Solo."
She blushes a little at having mentioned kissing in front of the prince, but fiercely maintains eye contact. Alex finds himself craning his neck farther, watching for Henry's reaction. He definitely does not recall Star Wars on the fact sheet.
"You know what?" Henry says, leaning in conspiratorially. "I think you've got the right idea."
Claudette giggles.
"Who's your favorite?"
Henry says, making a show of thinking hard.
"I always liked Luke. He's brave and good, and he's the strongest Jedi of them all. I think Luke is proof that it doesn't matter where you're from or who your family is. You can always be great if you're true to yourself."
"All right, Miss Claudette,"
a nurse says brightly as she comes around the curtain. Henry jumps, and Alex almost tips his chair over, caught in the act. He clears his throat as he stands, pointedly not looking at Henry.
"You two can go. It's time for her meds." "Miss Beth, Henry says we were mates now," Claudette practically wails. "He can stay."
"Excuse you," Beth the nurse tuts. "That's no way to address the prince."
"Terribly sorry, your highness."
"No need to apologize," Henry tells her. "Rebel commanders outrank royalty."
He shoots Claudette a wink and a salute, and she positively melts.
"I'm impressed," Alex says as they walk out into the hallway together.
Henry cocks an eyebrow, and Alex adds, "Not impressed, just surprised."
"At what?"
"That you actually have, you know, feelings." Henry is beginning to smile when three things happen in rapid succession. The first, a shout echoes from the opposite end of the hall. The second, there's a loud pop that sounds alarmingly like gunfire. The third, Cash grabs both Henry and Alex by the arms and shoves them through the nearest door.
"Stay down,"
Cash grunts as he slams the door behind them. In the abrupt darkness, Alex stumbles over a mop and one of Henry's legs, and they go crashing down together into a clattering pile of tin bedpans. Henry hits the floor first, face down, and Alex lands in a heap on top of him.
"Oh, God,"
Henry says, muffled and echoing slightly. Alex thinks hopefully that his face might be in a bedpan. "You know," he says into Henry's hair, "we have got to stop ending up like this."
"Do you mind?"
"This is your fault. How is this possibly my fault?" Henry hisses. "Nobody ever tries to shoot me when I'm doing presidential appearances, but the minute I go out with a fucking royal,
will you shut up before you get us both killed?"
"Nobody's going to kill us. Cash is blocking the door. Besides, it's probably nothing."
"Then at least get off me."
"Stop telling me what to do. You're not the prince of me."
"Bloody hell,"
Henry mutters, and he pushes hard off the ground and rolls, knocking Alex onto the floor. Alex finds himself wedged between Henry's side and a shelf of what smells like industrial-strength floor cleaner.
"Can you move over, Your Highness?" Alex whispers, shoving his shoulder against Henry's.
"I'd rather not be the little spoon."
"Believe me, I'm trying," Henry replies. "There's no room."
Outside, there are voices, hurried footsteps. No sign of an all clear.
"Well," Alex says, "guess we better make ourselves comfortable."
Henry exhales tightly.
"Fantastic."
Alex feels him shifting against his side, arms crossed over his chest in an attempt at his typical closed-off stance while lying on the floor with his feet in a mop bucket.
"For the record," Henry says, "nobody's ever made an attempt on my life either."
"Well, congratulations," Alex says. "You've officially made it."
"Yes, this is exactly how I always dreamed it would be. Locked in a cupboard with your elbow inside my ribcage."
Henry snipes. He sounds like he wants to punch Alex, which is probably the most Alex has ever liked him. So he follows an impulse and drives his elbow into Henry's side. Hard. Henry lets out a muffled yelp, and the next thing Alex knows, he's being yanked sideways by his shirt, and Henry is halfway on top of him, pinning him down with one thigh. His head throbs where he's clocked it against the linoleum floor, but he can feel his lips split into a smile.
"So, you do have some fight in you," Alex says.
He bucks his hips, trying to shake Henry off, but he's taller and stronger and has a fistful of Alex's collar.
"Are you quite finished?"
Henry says, sounding strangled.
"Can you perhaps stop putting your sodding life in danger now?"
"Aw, you do care," Alex says. "I'm learning all your hidden depths today, sweetheart."
Henry exhales and slumps off him.
"I cannot believe even mortal peril will not prevent you from being the way you are."
The weirdest part, Alex thinks, is that what he said was true. He keeps getting these little glimpses into things he never thought Henry was. A bit of a fighter, for one. Intelligent. Interested in other people. It's honestly disconcerting. He knows exactly what to say to each Democratic senator to make them dish about bills, exactly when Zara's running low on nicotine gum, exactly which look to give Nora for the rumor mill. Reading people is what he does. He really doesn't appreciate some inbred royal baby upending his system, but he did rather enjoy that fight. He lies there, waits, listens to the shuffling of feet outside the door. Let's minutes go by.
So, he tries.
"Star Wars?"
He means it in a non-threatening, offhanded way, but habit wins and it comes out accusatory.
"Yes, Alex,"
Henry says archly.
"Believe it or not, the children of the crown don't only spend their childhood going to tea parties."
"I assumed it was mostly posture coaching and junior polo league."
Henry takes a deeply unhappy pause.
"That may have been part of it."
"So, you're into pop culture, but you act like you're not," Alex says. "Either you're not allowed to talk about it because it's unseemly for the crown, or you choose not to talk about it because you want people to think you're cultured."
"Which one?"
"Are you psychoanalyzing me?" Henry asks. "I don't think royal guests are allowed to do that."
I'm trying to understand why you're so committed to acting like someone you're not, considering you just told that little girl in there that greatness means being true to yourself.
I don't know what you're talking about, and if I did, I'm not sure that's any of your concern,
Henry says, his voice strained at the edges.
Really?
Because I'm pretty sure I'm legally bound to pretend to be your best friend, and I don't know if you've thought this through yet, but that's not going to stop with this weekend,
Alex tells him.
Henry's fingers go tense against his forearm. If we do this, and we're never seen together again, people are going to know we're full of shit. We're stuck with each other, like it or not. So I have a right to be clued in about what your deal is before it sneaks up on me and bites me in the ass.
Why don't we start?
Henry says, turning his head to squint at him. This close, Alex can just make out the silhouette of Henry's strong royal nose. With you telling me why exactly you hate me so much. Do you really want to have that conversation?
Maybe I do.
Alex crosses his arms, recognizes it as a mirror to Henry's tick, and uncrosses them. Do you really not remember being a prick to me at the Olympics? Alex remembers it in vivid detail. Himself at 18, dispatched to Rio with June and Nora, the campaign's delegation to the Summer Games. One weekend of photo ops and selling the next generation of global cooperation image. Alex spent most of it drinking caipirinhas, and subsequently throwing caipirinhas up behind Olympic venues. And he remembers, down to the Union Jack on Henry's anorak, the first time they met. Henry sighs.
Is that the time you threatened to push me into the Thames?
No, Alex says. It was the time you were a condescending prick at the diving finals.
You really don't remember?
Remind me?
Alex glares. I walked up to you to introduce myself, and you stared at me like I was the most offensive thing you had ever seen. Right after you shook my hand, you turned to Sean and said, "Can you get rid of him?" A pause.
Ah, Henry says. He clears his throat. I didn't realize you'd heard that.
I feel like you're missing the point, Alex says, which is that it's a douchey thing to say either way.
That's fair.
Yeah, so.
That's all? Henry asks. Only the Olympics?
I mean, that was the start.
Henry pauses again. I'm sensing an ellipsis.
It's just, Alex says, and as he's on the floor of a supply closet, waiting out a security threat with a Prince of England at the end of a weekend that has felt like some very specific ongoing nightmare, censoring himself takes too much effort.
I don't know. Doing what we do is fucking hard. But it's harder for me. I'm the son of the first female president, and I'm not white like she is. Can't even pass for it. People will always come down harder on me. And you're, you know, you. And you were born into all of this, and everyone thinks you're Prince fucking Charming. You're basically a living reminder I'll always be compared to someone else, no matter what I do, even if I work twice as hard.
Henry is quiet for a long while.
Well, Henry says when he speaks at last, I can't very well do much about the rest. But I can tell you, I was, in fact, a prick that day. Not that it's any excuse, but my father had died 14 months before, and I was still kind of a prick every day of my life at the time. And I am sorry.
Henry twitches one hand at his side, and Alex falls momentarily silent.
The cancer ward.
Of course.
Henry chose a cancer ward. It was right there on the fact sheet. Father, famed film star Arthur Fox, deceased 2015, pancreatic cancer. The funeral was televised. He goes back over the last 24 hours in his head. The sleeplessness, the pills, the tense little grimace Henry does in public that Alex has always read as aloofness. He knows a few things about this stuff. It's not like his parents' divorce was a pleasant time for him. Or like he runs himself ragged about grades for fun. He's been aware for too long that most people don't navigate thoughts of whether they'll ever be good enough, or if they're disappointing the entire world. he's never considered Henry might feel any of the same things. Henry clears his throat again, and something like panic catches Alex. He opens his mouth and says, "Well, good to know you're not perfect." He can almost hear Henry roll his eyes, and he's thankful for it. The familiar comfort of antagonism. They're silent again, the dust of the conversation settling. Alex can't hear anything outside the door or any sirens on the street, but nobody has come to get them yet. Then, unprompted, Henry says into the stretching stillness, "Return of the Jedi."
"A beat."
"What?" "To answer your question," Henry says, "yes, I do like Star Wars, and my favorite is Return of the Jedi." "Oh," Alex says. "Wow, you're wrong." Henry huffs out the tiniest, most partially indignant puff of air. It smells minty. Alex resists the urge to throw another elbow. "How can I be wrong about my own favorite? It's a personal truth."
"It's a personal truth that is wrong and bad."
"Which do you prefer, then?
Please, show me the error of my ways."
"Okay. Empire." Henry sniffs.
"So dark, though."
"Yeah, which is what makes it good," Alex says. "It's the most thematically complex. It's got the Han and Leia kiss in it. You meet Yoda. Han is at the top of his game. Fucking Lando Calrissian. And the best twist in cinematic history." "What does Jedi have?" "Fucking Ewoks."
"Ewoks are iconic."
"Ewoks are stupid."
"But Endor."
"But Hoth." "There's a reason people always call the best, grittiest installment of a trilogy the Empire of the series."
"And I can appreciate that.
But isn't there something to be valued in a happy ending as well?"
"Spoken like a true Prince Charming."
"I'm only saying, I like the resolution of Jedi. It ties everything up nicely. And the overall theme you're intended to take away from the films is hope and love and, you know, all that. Which is what Jedi leaves you with a sense of most of all."
Henry coughs, and Alex is turning to look at him again when the door opens and Cash's giant silhouette reappears. "False alarm," he says, breathing heavily. "Some dumbass kids brought fireworks for their friend."
He looks down at them, flat on their backs and blinking up in the sudden, harsh light of the hallway.
"This looks cozy."
"Yep, we're really bonding," Alex says. He reaches a hand out and lets Cash haul him to his feet. Outside Kensington Palace, Alex takes Henry's phone out of his hand and swiftly opens a blank contact page before he can protest or sic a PPO on him for violating royal property. The car is waiting to take him back to the royal's private airstrip. "Here," Alex says, "that's my number. If we're going to keep this up, it's going to get annoying to keep going through handlers. Just text me. We'll figure it out." Henry stares at him, expression blankly bewildered, and Alex wonders how this guy has any friends.
"Right," Henry says finally. "Thank you."
"No booty calls," Alex tells him, and Henry chokes on a laugh. Chapter 3 From America with Love, Henry and Alex flaunt friendship. New bromance alert? Pics of F. Sotis and Prince Henry. Photos. Alex's weekend in London. For the first time in a week, Alex isn't pissed off scrolling through his Google alerts. It helps they've given People an exclusive. A few generic quotes about how much Alex cherishes his friendship with Henry and their shared life experience as sons of world leaders. Alex thinks their main shared life experience is probably wishing they could set that quote adrift on the ocean between them and watch it drown. His mother doesn't want him fake dead anymore, though, and he stopped getting 1,000 vitriolic tweets an hour, so he counts it as a win. He dodges a starstruck freshman gawking at him and exits the hall onto the east side of campus, draining the last cold sip of his coffee. First class today was an elective he's taking out of a combination of morbid fascination and academic curiosity. The press and the presidency.
He's currently jet-lagged to all hell from trying to keep the press from ruining the presidency. And the irony isn't lost on him. Today's lecture was on presidential sex scandals through history, and he texts Nora. Numbers on one of us getting involved in a sex scandal before the end of second term? Her response comes within seconds. 94% probability of your dick becoming a recurring personality on Face the Nation. By the way, have you seen this? There's a link attached. A blog post full of images, animated GIFs of himself and Henry on This Morning. The fist bump. Shared smiles that pass for genuine. Conspiratorial glances. Underneath are hundreds of comments about how handsome they are, how nice they look together. OMFG, one commenter writes, make out already. Alex laughs so hard, he almost falls in a fountain. As usual, the day guard at the Dirksen building glares at him as he slides through security. She's certain he was the one who vandalized the sign outside one particular senator's office to read, Bitch McConnell. But she'll never prove it. Cash tags along for some of Alex's Senate recon missions, so nobody panics when he disappears for a few hours. Today, Cash hangs back on a bench, catching up on his podcasts. He's always been the most indulgent of Alex's antics. Alex has had the layout of the building memorized since his dad first got elected to the Senate. It's where he picked up his encyclopedic knowledge of policy and procedure, and where he spends more afternoons than he's supposed to, charming aides and trawling for gossip. His mom pretends to be annoyed, but slyly asks for intel later. Since Senator Oscar Diaz is in California speaking at a rally for gun control today, Alex punches the button for the fifth floor instead. His favorite senator is Rafael Luna, an independent from Colorado and the newest kid on the block at only 39. Alex's dad took him under his wing back when he was merely a promising attorney, and now he's the darling of national politics for A, winning a special election and a general in consecutive upsets for his Senate seat, and B, dominating the Hill's 50 Most Beautiful. Alex spent summer 2018 in Denver on Luna's campaign, so they have their own dysfunctional relationship built on tropical-flavored Skittles from gas stations and all-nighters drafting press releases. He sometimes feels the ghost of carpal tunnel creeping back. A fond ache. He finds Luna in his office, horn-rimmed reading glasses doing nothing to detract from his usual appearance of a movie star who tripped and fell sideways into politics. Alex has always suspected the soulful brown eyes and perfectly groomed stubble and dramatic cheekbones won back any votes Luna lost by being both Latino and openly gay. The album playing low in the room is an old favorite Alex remembers from Denver, Muddy Waters. When Luna looks up and sees Alex in his doorway, he drops his pen on a haphazard pile of papers and leans back in his chair. "Fuck you doing here, kid," he says, watching him like a cat. Alex reaches into his pocket and pulls out a packet of Skittles, and Luna's face immediately softens into a smile.
"Attaboy,"
he says, scooping the bag up as soon as Alex drops it on his blotter. He kicks the chair in front of the desk out for him. Alex sits, watching Luna rip open the packet with his teeth. "What you working on today?"
"You already know more than you're supposed to about everything on this desk."
Alex does know. The same healthcare reform as last year. The one stalled out since they lost the Senate in midterms.
"Why are you really here?"
Alex hooks a leg over one armrest of the chair. "I resent the idea I can't come visit a dear family friend without ulterior motives."
"Bullshit."
He clutches his chest. "You wound me."
"You exhaust me."
"I enchant you."
"I'll call security."
"Fair enough."
"Instead, let's talk about your little European vacation," Luna says.
He fixes Alex with shrewd eyes.
"Can I expect a joint Christmas present from you and the prince this year?"
"Actually," Alex swerves, "since I'm here, I do have a question for you." Luna laughs, leaning back and lacing his hands together behind his head. Alex feels his face flash hot for half a second. A zip of good banter adrenaline that means he's getting somewhere.
"Of course you do."
"I
wondered if you had heard anything about Connor, Alex asks. We could really use an endorsement from another independent senator. Do you think he's close to making one?
He kicks his foot innocently where it's dangling over the armrest, like he's asking something as innocuous as the weather. Stanley Connor, Delaware's kooky and beloved old independent with a social media team stacked with millennials, would be a big get down the line in a race projected to be this close, and they both know it. Luna sucks on a Skittle.
Are you asking if he's close to endorsing, or if I know what strings need to be pulled to get him to endorse?
Raph, pal, buddy, you know I'd never ask you anything so unseemly.
Luna sighs, swivels in his chair.
He's a free agent. Social issues would push him your way usually, but you know how he feels about your mom's economic platform. You probably know his voting record better than I do, kid. He doesn't fall on one side of the aisle. He might go for something radically different on taxes.
And as for something you know that I don't?
He smirks.
I know Richards is promising independence a centrist platform with big shakeups on non-social issues, and I know part of that platform might not line up with Connor's position on healthcare. Somewhere to start, perhaps. Hypothetically, if I were going to engage with your scheming.
And you don't think there's any point in chasing down leads on Republican candidates who aren't Richards?
Shit, Luna says, the set of his mouth turning grim. Chances of your mother facing off against a candidate who's not the fucking anointed messiah of right-wing populism and heir to the Richards family legacy? Highly fucking unlikely.
Alex smiles. You complete me, Raph.
Luna rolls his eyes again.
Let's circle back to you, he says. Don't think I didn't notice you changing the subject. For the record, I won the office pool on how long it'd take you to cause an international incident.
Wow, I thought I could trust you, Alex gasps, mock betrayed.
What's the deal there?
There's no deal, Alex says. Henry is a person I know, and we did something stupid. I had to fix it. It's fine.
Okay, okay, Luna says, holding up both hands. He's a looker, huh?
Alex pulls a face.
Yeah, I mean, if you're into, like, fairy tale princes. Is anyone not?
I'm not, Alex says. Luna arches an eyebrow.
Right.
What?
Just thinking about last summer, he says. I have this really vivid memory of you basically making a Prince Henry voodoo doll on your desk.
I did not. Or was it a dartboard with a photo of his face on it?
Alex swings his foot back over the armrest so he can plant both feet on the floor and fold his arms indignantly.
I had a magazine with his face on it at my desk once, because I was in it, and he happened to be on the cover.
You stared at it for an hour.
Lies, Alex says. Slander.
It was like you were trying to set him on fire with your mind.
What is your point?
I think it's interesting, he says. How fast the times they are a-changin'.
Come on, Alex says. It's politics.
Uh-huh.
Alex shakes his head, dog-like, as if it's going to disperse the topic from the room. Besides, I came here to talk about endorsements, not my embarrassing public relations nightmares.
Ah, Luna says slyly, but I thought you were here to pay a family friend a visit.
Of course. That's what I meant.
Alex, don't you have something else to do on a Friday afternoon? You're 21. You should be playing beer pong or getting ready for a party or something.
I do all of those things, he lies. I just also do this.
Come on. I'm trying to give you some advice, from one old man to a much younger version of himself.
You're 39.
My liver's 93. That's not my fault. Some late nights in Denver would beg to differ.
Alex laughs. See? This is why we're friends.
Alex, you need other friends, Luna tells him. Friends who aren't in Congress.
I have friends. I have June and Nora.
Yep, your sister and a girl who is also a supercomputer. Luna deadpans. You need to take some time for yourself before you burn out, kid. You need a bigger support system.
Stop calling me kid, Alex says.
Hey, Luna sighs. Are you done?
I do have some actual work to do.
Yeah, yeah, Alex says, gathering himself up from his chair.
Hey, is Maxine in town?
Waters? Luna asks, crooking his head.
Shit. You really have a death wish, huh?
As political legacies go, the Richards family is one of the most complex bits of history Alex has tried to unravel. On one of the post-it notes stuck to his laptop, he's written, Kennedys plus Bushes plus bizarro mafia old money Sith powers equals Richardses? It's pretty much the thesis of what he's dug up so far. Jeffrey Richards, the current and supposedly only frontrunner to be his mother's opponent in the general, has been a senator for Utah nearly 20 years, which means plenty of voting history and legislation that his mother's team has already gone over. Alex is more interested in the things harder to sniff out. There are so many generations of Attorney General Richards and Federal Judge Richards, they'd be able to bury anything. His phone buzzes under a stack of files on his desk. A text from June.
Dinner? I miss your face.
He loves June. Truly, more than anything in the world, but he's kind of in the zone. He'll respond when he hits a stopping point in like 30 minutes. He glances at the video of a Richards interview pulled up in a tab, checking the man's face for nonverbal cues. Gray hair. Natural, not a piece. Shiny white teeth, like a shark's. Heavy Uncle Sam jaw. Great salesman, considering he's blatantly lying about a bill in the clip. Alex takes a note. It's an hour and a half later before another buzz pulls him out of a deep dive into Richards' uncle's suspicious 1986 taxes. A text from his mother in the family group chat. A pizza emoji. He bookmarks his page and heads upstairs. Family dinners are rare, but less over the top than everything else that happens in the White House. His mother sends someone to pick up pizzas, and they take over the game room on the third floor with paper plates and bottles of Shiner shipped in from Texas. It's always amusing to catch one of the burly suits speaking in code over their earpieces.
Black Bear has requested extra banana peppers.
June's already on the chaise and sipping a beer. A stab of guilt immediately hits when he remembers her text.
Shit, I'm an asshole, he says.
Mm-hmm, you are. But technically, I am having dinner with you.
Just bring me my pizza, she says with a sigh.
After Secret Service misread an olive-based shouting match in 2017 and almost put the residents on lockdown, they now each get their own pizzas.
Sure thing, bug.
He finds June's, margarita, and his, pepperoni and mushroom.
Hi, Alex, says a voice from somewhere behind the television as he settles in with his pizza.
Hey, Leo, he answers. His stepdad is fiddling with the wiring, probably rewiring it to do something that'd make more sense in an Iron Man comic, like he does with most electronics. Eccentric millionaire inventor habits die hard. He's about to ask for a dumbed-down explanation when his mother comes blazing in.
Why did y'all let me run for president?
She says, tapping too forcefully at her phone's keyboard in little staccato stabs. She kicks off her heels into the corner, throwing her phone after them.
Because we all knew better than to try to stop you, Leo's voice says.
He peeks his bearded, bespectacled head out and adds,
And because the world would fall apart without you, my radiant orchid.
His mother rolls her eyes, but smiles. It's always been like that with them, ever since they first met at a charity event when Alex was 14. She was the Speaker of the House, and he was a genius with a dozen patents and money to burn on women's health initiatives. Now she's the president, and he sold his company to spend his time fulfilling first gentleman duties. Ellen releases 2 inches of zipper on the back of her skirt, the sign she's officially done for the day, and scoops up a slice.
All right, she says.
She does a scrubbing gesture in the air in front of her face. President face off, mom face on.
Hi, babies.
Hello,
Alex and June mumble in unison through mouthfuls of food. Ellen sighs and looks over at Leo.
I did that, didn't I? No goddamn manners, like a couple of little opossums. This is why they say women can't have it all.
They are masterpieces, Leo says.
One good thing,
one bad thing, she says. Let's do this.
It's her lifelong system for catching up on their days when she's at her busiest. Alex grew up with a mother who was a sometimes baffling combination of intensely organized and committed to lines of emotional communication, like an overly invested life coach. When he got his first girlfriend, she made a PowerPoint presentation. June swallows a bite.
Good thing. Oh my God, Ronan Farrow tweeted about my essay for New York Magazine, and we totally engaged in witty Twitter repartee. Part one of my long game to force him to be my friend is underway.
Don't act like this isn't all a part of your extra long game of abusing your position to murder Woody Allen and make it look like an accident, Alex says.
He's just so frail. It'd only take one good push. How many times do I have to tell y'all not to discuss your murder plots in front of a sitting president?
Their mother interrupts.
Plausible deniability.
Come on.
Anyway, June says, one bad thing would be, Woody Allen's still alive. Your turn, Alex.
Good thing, Alex says. I filibustered one of my professors into agreeing a question on our last exam was misleading so I would get full credit for my answer, which was correct. He takes a swig of beer. Bad thing?
Mom, I saw the new art in the hall on the second floor, and I need to know why you allowed a George W. Bush terrier painting in our home.
It's a bipartisan gesture, Alan says.
People find them endearing.
I have to walk past it whenever I go to my room, Alex says. Its beady little eyes follow me everywhere.
It's staying.
Alex sighs.
Fine.
Leo goes next. As usual, his bad thing is somehow also a good thing. And then Ellen's up.
Well, my UN ambassador fucked up his one job and said something idiotic about Israel, and now I have to call Netanyahu and personally apologize. But the good thing is, it's 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv, so I can put it off until tomorrow and have dinner with you two instead.
Alex smiles at her. He's still in awe, sometimes, of hearing her talk about presidential pains in the ass, even 3 years in. They lapse into idle conversation, little barbs and inside jokes, and these nights may be rare, but they're still nice.
So, Ellen says, starting on another slice, crust first. I ever tell you I used to hustle pool at my mom's bar?
June stops short, her beer halfway to her mouth.
It did what now?
Yep, she tells them. Alex exchanges an incredulous look with June.
Mama managed this shitty bar when I was 16, the Tipsy Grackle. She let me come in after school and do my homework at the bar. Had a bouncer friend make sure none of the old drunks hit on me. I got pretty good at pool after a few months and started betting the regulars I could beat them. Except I'd play dumb. Hold the stick the wrong way, pretend to forget if I was stripes or solid. I'd lose one game, then take them double or nothing and get twice the payout.
You've got to be kidding me, Alex says. Except he can totally picture it. She has always been scary good at pool and even better at strategy.
All true, Leo says. How do you think she learned to get what she wants from strung-out old white men? The most important skill of an effective politician.
Alex's mother accepts a kiss to the side of her square jaw from Leo as she passes by, like a queen gliding through a crowd of admirers. She sets her half-eaten slice down on a paper towel and selects a cue stick from the rack.
Anyway, she says, the point is, you're never too young to figure out your skills and use them to get shit accomplished.
Okay, Alex says. He meets her eyes, and they swap appraising looks.
Including, she says thoughtfully, a job on a presidential re-election campaign, maybe.
June puts down her slice.
Mom, he's not even out of college yet.
Yeah, that's the point, Alex says impatiently.
He's been waiting for this offer. No gaps in the resume.
It's not only for Alex, their mother says.
It's for both of you.
June's expression changes from pinched apprehension to pinched dread. Alex makes a shooing motion in June's direction. A mushroom flies off his pizza and hits the side of her nose.
Tell me. I've been thinking.
Ellen says. This time around, y'all, the White House trio.
She puts it in air quotes, as if she didn't sign off on the name herself.
Y'all shouldn't only be faces. Y'all are more than that. You have skills. You're smart. You're talented. We could use y'all not only as surrogates, but as staffers.
Mom, June starts. What positions? Alex interjects. She pauses, drifts back over to her slice of pizza.
Alex, you're the family wonk, she says, taking a bite. We could have you running point on policy. This means a lot of research and a lot of writing.
Fuck yes, Alex says. Let me romance the hell out of some focus group I'm in.
Alex, June starts again, but their mom cuts her off.
June, I'm thinking communications, she goes on. Since your degree is mass comm, I was thinking you can come handle some of the day-to-day liaising with media outlets, working on messaging, analyzing the audience.
Mom, I have a job, she says.
Oh yeah, I mean, of course, sugar. But this could be full-time. Connections, upward mobility, real experience in the field, doing some amazing work.
June rips a piece of crust off her pizza. Don't remember ever saying I wanted to do anything like that. That's a kind of a big assumption to make, Mom.
And you realize if I go into campaign communications now, I'm basically shutting down my chances of ever being a journalist. Because, like, journalistic neutrality and everything. I can barely get anyone to let me write a column as it is.
Baby girl, their mom says.
She's got that look on her face she gets when she's saying something with a 50-50 chance of pissing you off.
You're so talented, and I know you work hard, but at some point, you have to be realistic.
What's that supposed to mean?
I just mean, I don't know if you're happy, she says, and maybe it's time to try something different. That's all.
I'm not y'all, June tells her.
This isn't my thing.
June, Alex says, tilting his head back to look at her upside down over the arm of his chair.
Just think about it.
I'm doing it. He looks back at their mom. Are you offering a job to Nora, too?
She nods. Mike is talking to her tomorrow about a position in analytics. If she takes it, she'll start ASAP.
You, mister, are not starting until after graduation.
Oh, man, the White House trio riding into battle. This is awesome.
He looks over at Leo, who has abandoned his project with the TV and is now happily eating a slice of cheesy bread.
They offer you a job, Leo?
No, he says. As usual, my duties as first gentleman are to work on my tablescapes and look pretty.
Your tablescapes are really coming along, baby, Ellen says, giving him a sarcastic little kiss. I really liked the burlap placemats.
Can you believe the decorator thought velvet looked better?
Bless her heart.
I don't like this, June says to Alex while their mother is distracted talking about decorative pears.
Are you sure you want this job?
It's gonna be fine, June, he tells her. Hey, if you want to keep an eye on me, you can always take the offer too.
She shakes him off, returning to her pizza with an unreadable expression.
The next day, there are three matching sticky notes on the whiteboard on Zara's office. Campaign jobs. Alex, Nora, June, the board reads. The sticky notes under his and Nora's names read, yes. Under June's, in what is unmistakably her own handwriting, no. Alex is taking notes in a policy lecture when he gets the first text.
This bloke looks like you.
There's a picture attached. An image of a laptop screen paused on Chief Chirpa from Return of the Jedi. Tiny, commanding, adorable, pissed off.
This is Henry, by the way.
He rolls his eyes, but adds the new contact to his phone. HRH Prince Dickhead, poop emoji. He's honestly not planning to respond, but a week later he sees a headline on the cover of People. Prince Henry flies south for winter. Complete with a photo of Henry artistically posed on an Australian beach in a pair of sensible yet minuscule navy swim trunks. And he can't stop himself.
You have a lot of moles, he texts, along with a snap of the spread. Is that a result of the inbreeding?
Henry's retort comes 2 days later, by way of a screenshot of a Daily Mail tweet that reads, "Is Alex Claremont Diaz going to be a father?" The attached message says, "But we were ever so careful, dear." Which surprises a big enough laugh out of Alex that Zara ejects him from her weekly debriefing with him in June. So it turns out Henry can be funny. Alex adds this to his mental file. It also turns out Henry is fond of texting when he's trapped in moments of royal monotony, like being shuttled to and from appearances, or sitting through meandering briefings on his family's landholdings, or, once, begrudgingly and hilariously, receiving a spray tan. Alex wouldn't say he likes Henry, but he does enjoy the quick rhythm of arguments they fall into. He knows he talks too much, hopeless at moderating his feelings, which he usually hides under 10 layers of charm, but he ultimately doesn't care what Henry thinks of him, so he doesn't bother. Instead, he's as weird and manic as he wants to be, and Henry jabs back in sharp flashes of startling wit. So, when he's bored or stressed or between coffee refills, he'll check for a text bubble popping up. Henry with a dig at some weird quote from his latest interview. Henry with a random thought about English beer versus American beer. A picture of Henry's dog wearing a Slytherin scarf. "I don't know who you think you're kidding, you Hufflepuff-ass bitch," Alex texts back, before Henry clarifies his dog, not him, is a Slytherin. He learns about Henry's life through a weird osmosis of text messages and social media. It's meticulously scheduled by Sean, with whom Alex is slightly obsessed, especially when Henry texts him things like, "Did I tell you Sean has a motorbike?" or "Sean is on the phone with Portugal." It's quickly becoming apparent the HRH Prince Henry fact sheet either omitted the most interesting stuff or was outright fabricated. Henry's favorite food isn't mutton pie, but a cheap falafel stand 10 minutes from the palace, and he spent most of his gap year thus far working on charities around the world, half of them owned by his best friend, Pez. Alex learns Henry's super into classical mythology and can rattle off the configurations of a few dozen constellations if you let him get going. Alex hears more about the tedious details of operating a sailboat than he would ever care to know, and sends back nothing but, "Cool." 8 hours later. Henry hardly ever swears, but at least he doesn't seem to mind Alex's filthy fucking mouth. Henry's sister, Beatrice, she goes by B, Alex finds out, pops up often, since she lives in Kensington Palace as well. From what he gathers, the two of them are closer than either are to their brother. They compare notes on the trials and tribulations of having older sisters. Did B force you into dresses as a child too? Has June also got a fondness for sneaking your leftover curry out of the refrigerator in the dead of night like a Dickensian street urchin? More common are cameos by Pez, a man who cuts such an intriguing and bizarre figure that Alex wonders how someone like him ever became best friends with someone like Henry, who can drone on about Lord Byron until you threaten to block his number. He's always either doing something insane, base jumping in Malaysia, eating plantains with someone who might be Jay-Z, showing up to lunch wearing a studded, hot pink Gucci jacket, or launching a new nonprofit. It's kind of incredible. He realizes that he's shared June and Nora, too, when Henry remembers June's Secret Service code name is Bluebonnet, or jokes about how eerie Nora's photographic memory is. It's weird, considering how fiercely protective Alex is of them, that he never even noticed until Henry's Twitter exchange with June about their mutual love of the 2005 Pride and Prejudice movie goes viral. "That's not your emails from Zara face," Nora says, nosing her way over his shoulder. He elbows her away. "You keep doing that stupid smile every time you look at your phone. Who are you texting?" "I don't know what you're talking about, and literally no one," Alex tells her. From the screen in his hand, Henry's message reads, "In world's most boring meeting with Philip. Don't let the papers print lies about me after I've garrotted myself with my tie." "Wait," she says, reaching for his phone again. "Are you watching videos of Justin Trudeau speaking French again?" "That's not a thing I do." "That is a thing I have caught you doing at least twice since you met him at the state dinner last year. So yeah, it is," she says. Alex flips her off. "Wait, oh my God, is it fan fiction about yourself? And you didn't invite me?
Who do they have you boning now? Did you read the one I sent you with Macron? I died.
If you don't stop, I'm going to call Taylor Swift and tell her you changed your mind and want to go to her 4th of July party after all.
That is not a proportional response.
Later that night, once he's alone at his desk, he replies. Was it a meeting about which of your cousins have to marry each other to take back Casterly Rock?
Ha! Huh. It was about royal finances. I'll be hearing Philip's voice saying the words, "Return on investment," in my nightmares for the rest of time.
Alex rolls his eyes and sends back, "The harrowing struggle of managing the Empire's blood money." Henry's response comes a minute later.
That was actually the crux of the meeting.
I've tried to refuse my share of the Crown's money. Dad left us each more than enough, and I'd rather cover my expenses with that than the spoils of, you know, centuries of genocide. Philip thinks I'm being ridiculous.
Alex scans the message twice to make sure he's read it correctly.
I am low-key impressed. He stares at the screen, at his own message for a few seconds too long, suddenly afraid it was a stupid thing to say. He shakes his head, puts the phone down, locks it. Changes his mind, picks it up again, unlocks it. Sees the little typing bubble on Henry's side of the conversation. Puts the phone down, looks away, looks back.
One does not foster a lifelong love of Star Wars without knowing an empire isn't a good thing.
He would really appreciate it if Henry would stop proving him wrong. Text conversation with HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji. October 30, 2019, 1:07 p.m. I hate that tie. HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji. What tie? The one in that Instagram you just posted. HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji. What's wrong with it? It's only gray.
Exactly. Try patterns sometime. And stop frowning at your phone like I know you're doing right now.
HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji.
Patterns are considered a statement. Royals aren't supposed to make statements with what we wear.
Do it for the gram.
HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji. You are the thistle in the tender and sensitive arse crack of my life.
Thanks. November 17, 2019, 11:04 a.m. HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji.
I've just received a 5-kilo parcel of Ellen Claremont campaign buttons with your face on them. Is this your idea of a prank?
Just trying to brighten up that wardrobe, sunshine.
HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji.
I hope this gross miscarriage of campaign funds is worth it to you. My security thought it was a bomb. Sean almost called in the sniffer dogs.
Oh, definitely worth it. Even more worth it now. Tell Sean I say hi and I miss that sweet, sweet ass. Kisses and hugs.
HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji.
I will not.
Chapter 4.
It's public knowledge. It's not my problem you just found out, his mother is saying, pacing double time down a West Wing corridor.
You mean to tell me, Alex half shouts, jogging to keep up, every Thanksgiving, those stupid turkeys have been staying in a luxury suite at the Willard on the taxpayer's dime?
Yes, Alex, they do.
Gross government waste!
And there are 2 40-pound turkeys named Cornbread and Stuffing in a motorcade on Pennsylvania Avenue right now. There is no time to reallocate the turkeys.
Without missing a beat, he blurts out,
Bring them to the house.
Where? Are you hiding a turkey habitat up your ass, son? Where in our historically protected house am I going to put a couple of turkeys until I pardon them tomorrow?
Put them in my room. I don't care.
She outright laughs.
No. How is it different from a hotel room? Put the turkeys in my room, Mom.
I'm not putting the turkeys in your room. Put the turkeys in my room.
No.
Put them in my room. Put them in my room. Put them in my room.
That night, as Alex stares into the cold, pitiless eyes of a prehistoric beast of prey, he has a few regrets.
They know, he texts Henry. They know I have robbed them of 5-star accommodations to sit in a cage in my room, and the minute I turn my back, they're going to feast on my flesh.
Cornbread stares emptily back at him from inside a huge crate next to Alex's couch. A farm vet comes by once every few hours to check on them. Alex keeps asking if she can detect a lust for blood,
From the ensuite, stuffing releases another ominous gobble. Alex was going to get things accomplished tonight. He really was. Before he learned of exorbitant turkey expenditures from CNN, he was watching the highlights of last night's Republican primary debate. He was going to finish an outline for an exam, then study the demographic engagement binder he convinced his mother to give him for the campaign job. Instead, he is in a prison of his own creation, sworn to babysit these turkeys until the pardon ceremony, and is just now realizing his deep-seated fear of large birds. He considers finding a couch to sleep on, but what if these demons from hell break out of their cages and murder each other during the night when he's supposed to be watching them? Breaking, both turkeys found dead in bedroom of F. Sotis, turkey pardon canceled in disgrace. F. Sotis, a satanic turkey ritual killer. Please send photos, is Henry's idea of a comforting response. He drops onto the edge of his bed. He's grown accustomed to texting with Henry almost every day. The time difference doesn't matter, since they're both awake at all ungodly hours of the day and night. Henry will send a snap from a 7 a.m. polo practice and promptly receive one of Alex at 2 a.m., glasses on and coffee in hand, in bed with a pile of notes. Alex doesn't know why Henry never responds to his selfies from bed. His selfies from bed are always hilarious. He snaps a shot of cornbread and presses send, flinching when the bird flaps at him threateningly. I think he's cute, Henry responds. That's because you can't hear all the menacing gobbling.
Yes, famously the most sinister of all animal sounds, the gobble.
You know what, you little shit, Alex says the second the call connects. You can hear it for yourself, and then tell me how you would handle this.
Alex?
Henry's voice sounds scratchy and bewildered across the line. Have you really rung me at 3 o'clock in the morning to make me listen to a turkey?
Yes, obviously, Alex says.
He glances at cornbread and cringes.